Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly double stab of rationality in a triply politically irrational world, brought to you by the magazine Free Minds and Free Markets. I am a totally normal Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy T-minus 8 days, everyone.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Wow. Suderman's got a spring to his... It must be cold up there. We're going to get to the closing arguments in the presidential race here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsors over at St. John's College. Friends, do you know who's welcome at St. John's College? Everyone. That's who's welcome. From America's founding fathers to the Greek philosophers who inspired them to contemporary critics who were not quite sure that the aforementioned are as awesome as all that. At St. John's College, students encounter Adam Smith and Karl Marx, James Baldwin and Virginia Woolf, St. Augustine and Nietzsche. Here, there are no secondary sources, no experts, and no one, I repeat, no one telling you what to believe, let alone you. Instead, it's original sources researched in a community devoted to collaborative inquiry, intellectual humility, and the open discomfort that comes from encountering diverse opinions. Explore 3,000 years of human thought on campuses in beautiful Santa Fe and historic Annapolis. For master's degree candidates, St. John's also offers studies in the great texts of the East, in person or online. Learn more at sjc.edu/reason. That is sjc.edu/reason. Go there today. You will be glad you did. All right. More than 40 million Americans have already voted. Catherine, is that you too? Have you done that yet? Okay, just checking. That's like a quarter of the total from the 2020 presidential election. I do suspect that some of our loyal listeners out there in loyal listener land have yet to make up their mind. You're playing ballot box Hamlet. We are here to help you with your pain. Normally, libertarians tend to be the annoying people who kind of exaggerate about how similar and totally the same the two candidates, the two political parties are. And it is true that in many kind of important respects this time around, on certain economic, fiscal, even antitrust policies, there are some similarities that we've probably brought up a couple of times here on this podcast. But there are also some important issues where there is pretty clear daylight between the two major party candidates, who I believe are Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. So that's what we are here to explore today. Catherine, you are the editor of a libertarian magazine, so I've been told. What is one key issue of particular interest to libertarians where Trump and Harris have significant differences?
I want to talk about tariffs because I am the editor of a libertarian magazine, I guess. But I think that there are some really important differences here, and it's easy to wave them away because both candidates have pretty bad policy proposals. So I do want to establish that, like, both are on the not great side of the spectrum, but there's bad and worse, and bad and worse are important. So Trump has a history of, you know, being very aggressive with tariffs. He has proposed an across-the-board universal 10% tax on all imports. Sometimes it's 20%. It's a little unclear. This is supposed to be an America First policy, and it would be, I really can't say this clearly enough, a disaster. It would be really, really, really bad for the American economy to do such a thing. Harris has pushed back on Trump's plan, but also Biden kept a lot of Trump's tariffs in place, and Harris would increase some of them. They would be more targeted. It's, you know, green energy this and, you know, China that. But we're still looking at increased tariffs in some strategic places. This is a really important difference between the candidates. And if Trump does anything like what he says he's going to do, it would be ruinous for the U.S. economy. So
what do tariffs. So in judging all of these things, there is what the candidate says that he or she is going to do, and the, you know, what can they do as president, and what is plausible that they might do in conjunction with Congress. Where do tariffs weigh in on that, in your estimation?
Yeah, I mean, presidents do have some power in this arena. And so that's one reason I picked this category, because a lot of what they are talking about, they really don't have the power to change. So I think you could say, for instance, oh, there's a really big difference between the candidates on healthcare policy, but presidents don't make healthcare policy. They can and will strongly influence, our tariffs and foreign trade. I think that... of course, it matters whether there's a cooperative Congress, and so it's TBD. I also think it matters whether you just take Trump seriously or literally, right? Like, he would love to do the thing he is describing. He would totally do it if he could. Can he? Will he bother once he's in office? Who knows?
The Tax Foundation did a really interesting scoring of Trump and Harris's tax plans. And one of the things they talked about in terms of tariffs is, because the president has such wide latitude to impose tariffs, that if Trump actually put in the tariffs that he's discussed and was not able to enact tax reform, because that does take Congress, it would be the seventh largest tax increase since 1941. And it would be the equivalent of about 1.08% of GDP, which is gigantic. So this is one of those things where, if Trump, he's talking about massive tax cuts plus tariffs. And when you look at it that way, then it becomes a big tax cut. But he can't actually do the tax cuts. If he actually just enacts the tariffs, this is a major, major deal. And he might just be vindictive enough to do that.
Yeah, it's also worth noting that the same folks have looked at how taxes changed under Biden, and I know we're going to get into broader economic stuff later, but taxes have gone down on wealthy people when you kind of go all in under Biden, according to some calculations. And so it's just worth keeping in mind, these guys are running on one thing, and they might in fact create a totally different tax environment based on what they can do themselves versus what Congress has to do.
Peter, maybe take the baton here, and you're going to talk about more about broader econ policy, maybe fold tariffs into it and go.
Yeah. So the thing I want to talk about specifically is the deficit. And this is the big picture fiscal situation. So the deficit, of course, is the gap between tax revenue, what the government brings in taxes, and what it spends. And there's a deficit every year. This year it is quite large. Those deficits then contribute to the total debt, because that gap piles up and creates the public debt here. And so the two candidates, Harris and Trump, are running in ways that are kind of the inverse of each other, at least if you look at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget's analysis here, because Trump would keep spending more or less the same, if you look at his plans, while reducing tax revenues. And that creates a bigger budget deficit, right? Because the gap between the two has created a bigger budget deficit. So lower taxes, but about the same amount of spending, and a bigger budget deficit. Harris, meanwhile, would increase spending, but would keep tax revenues about the same, also creating a bigger budget deficit. Those two things, however, are not precisely equal. According to the CRFB central estimate, Harris's plans would result in a smaller increase in the deficit. Still a big increase, but a smaller increase than Trump. So if you care about the gap purely as if you think the thing that matters is the distance between the amount of spending and the amount of tax revenue, then Trump is worse here. On the other hand, if you care about the thing that Nick talks about on this podcast all the time, which is, Milton Friedman's argument that the way you measure size of government is actually how much it spends. Trump's plans, at least as he's described them, and we have to go back here and say, a lot of these plans are barely plans. They are not really fleshed out. They're kind of brain farts that happen on the campaign trail. It's really hard to say if any of them would happen, and even if they did happen, exactly what shape they would take. But if you sort of make a serious and substantive attempt to look at Trump's plans, you have lower taxes and lower spending than you would have under Harris, but you would have a bigger deficit. But either way, what you are getting is an increase in the deficit from what we have right now, and a worsening fiscal situation when it's already very bad. And in fact, I think the thing to focus on here is that both candidates, even though there are differences, both candidates would represent, would deliver over the next decade or so, would put us on a track to record deficit levels outside of any kind of true emergency situation, outside of a war or a pandemic or anything like that. And so this is the difficult choice that I think that people who care about the budget have to make right now is, do you want a somewhat smaller government with much lower tax revenues that don't cover it? And again, this is smaller. Trump offers a smaller government, not relative to where we are now necessarily, but relative to Harris. Or do you want a somewhat larger government, but taxes that come a little closer to paying for it? It's a bad choice. It's a very bad choice. And I cannot make a recommendation here. There is a reason that I am non-voting once again. It's pretty ugly. And the debt and deficit issue has just not really played a big part in our policy discussion this year, because neither candidate has an answer to what are you going to do about the fact that we have runaway debt and deficits that nobody has a plan to resolve.
I think that that's actually a place where, you know, the candidates are very similar, because and I looked at the same CRFB report that Peter did, and it has Harris adding over, you know, the next bazillion years, about $4 trillion to the debt.
They scored at $3.5 trillion by 2035, whereas okay. Trump's plan would increase the debt by $7.5 trillion over the same period of time.
Yeah, I have slightly different figures, but roughly this, you know, in the estimate. And when you consider they're tacking that on to, you know, upwards of $30 trillion, that is not a lot of difference. I think that this is one of the places where you can also look at estimates of economic growth, which tend to be a little bit higher under Trump. But the debt is a bigger issue and things like that. So I just am bringing this up because I think this is not a point of difference. This is a point of sameness, and this is a real problem. And this is one of the reasons why I like somebody like Chase Oliver, because while he has no chance of winning, he is at least hitting the right note in that part of the choir.
So I do think it's a point of difference, but it's a point of difference where they're essentially in negatives of each other. And that means that in some ways they sort of fit over each other. There's some real similarity. On the other hand, they're perfectly polar opposites, or not perfectly, but they are in many ways kind of polar opposites. And it's a difficult choice to say that one is obviously better than the other. I definitely could see someone saying, well, look, presuming you that the CRFB analyses are right, we want a smaller deficit, Harris is the better choice. I can also see someone saying, look at Trump's plans. It's less spending than Harris is proposing, and it's lower taxes than Harris is proposing. I prefer that as a small government person. I think totally credible choice. You know, like, you can make either choice, but neither one is a good one. They're both going to make things worse.
Catherine?
I was actually just going to kind of agree with Peter and disagree with Nick a little bit. I think that these are real differences. And you know, I guess we're all very jaded now, but like, $4 trillion, $7 trillion, like, that's still trillion. Like, it's with a T, you know? So I think there's that.
Then who is better?
I mean, I think it's hard, but I do think it's different. I think, like, this will ultimately be the question that's going to shape the short term, because it is kind of the, well, do we value getting closer to balance, or do we just value smaller government and we let things kind of careen?
Well, maybe Friedman's wrong then when he says that spending is the ultimate measure of government.
I mean, that can't be right. Milton Friedman's never wrong.
He's been wrong about a lot of stuff.
Peter, just as a factual query, since you have been lost in the musk of CBO reports over the years, do these kind of projections? I know this is the Committee for Responsible Budget is not the CBO, but when people generally who are respected project future deficits, is there, in the same way that there are in, like, you know, projecting how much X project, government project, is going to cost.
How much
to build
writing
out.
One is going to get done by the end of the fiscal year?
Why would you attack me about my afternoon plans like that, Nick?
Now I'm thinking of myself. I'm sorry, did I say that out loud?
So, what is the track record on the undercounting, overcounting of projected future deficits, if that can be generalized?
The good folks at the CRFB have never once correctly projected how much I'm going to write in a week, but that's my fault and not theirs. So what I would say is that these folks are trying to do the best they can with really bad information, and particularly when it comes to campaign proposals, and particularly this year, where the campaign proposals are sketched out, often just sort of delivered in the midst of a rambling speech, even with something like Kamala Harris's proposal, this is not just Trump, though Trump is probably worse in some specific ways. But with some of Kamala Harris's proposals, the team will circulate something in advance privately to reporters, and then the way it's described in a public announcement is somewhat different. Very difficult to figure out exactly what these proposals are. And so, I really want to cut these folks a lot of slack. They're not going to get it precisely right. And one thing that is good about the CRFB's report here is that they have produced a central estimate, but also a high and a low estimate. And so they've tried to give us a range of sort of what's the middle figure, but also what's the high figure and what's the low figure, and sort of how big a divergence could there be here based on the types of things that could happen. When it comes to the Congressional Budget Office, the record is not so great, but the record is not so great because they're bad at their job. The record is not so great because it's really hard to predict what Congress and presidents are going to do. And I think that is true even when you have good, solid plans and when there's some clarity about what the legislation is and what it's going to be. But that is not the situation here. And so it's very difficult to tell and to make an informed choice because the information itself isn't there. I think this is the best information that we have, and this is what I'm trying to rely on. On the other hand, there is not enough information to make a very confident prediction about exactly what is going to happen. And I definitely would say anybody who thinks, oh, these numbers are the numbers, this is what's going to happen. No, this is definitely what's not what's going to happen, but this is a sketch of something that plausibly could happen based on what the candidates have said and what they have published on their websites and in whatever associated campaign material.
I will say that when you've mentioned brain fart a couple of times, Peter, when you look at what Kamala Harris has actually said about policy on a given topic, it is frequent, including what I will talk about in a little bit, that Trump has given a hell of a lot more detail, in part because he's done a hell of a lot more interviews. When you sit down with Joe Rogan for 3 hours, you're probably going to get into some policy discussions. When you don't do interviews, and also your website is like, we're going to give puppy dogs to flowers and vice versa, and not much else. She's had an incredible paucity of policy information on several things. Go ahead, Nick.
Well, you also know from Trump's first term, the majority of debt of legislation he signed that increased debt came before COVID. And it came mostly when the Republicans also controlled the House and the Senate. We know that Biden also, jacked up spending. If you look back at, and this again is to go into the idea of a uniparty, in 2008, 2009, just as the switchover from Bush to Obama, there was a lot of mixing of money, but spending went up massively and in a bipartisan way. And the same thing happened in 2020 to 2021, where there's a slopover effect. But, what we know, compared to 2000 or 2001, the last Clinton budget, and now we are, we went from under $2 trillion or around $2 trillion in nominal dollars to over $6 trillion. And so that was both parties at different times leading the way or holding it back a little bit. But we know that what these two parties not only are capable of, but what they do on a regular basis. which is spend more.
The other thing to think about very briefly here, since we've brought Congress into this equation, is that if Trump wins the White House, it is very likely that he will have a unified Republican House and Republican Senate, and that is going to give him the capacity to do a bunch more. And that a uniparty in Congress, that an all-Republican majority in Congress plus a Republican in the White House is probably a recipe for a lot more spending. Whereas if Kamala Harris wins the White House, there is a much better chance, I think, of having divided government, where you have at least one chamber of Congress controlled by Republicans. And that creates blockages and some checks and some disagreements there. And that might be, I think, for some people who are libertarians and small government types, that might be maybe not a good outcome, but a better outcome to have divided government. And the way we're most likely to get divided government is with a Harris victory.
All right. The assignment is not uniparty. This assignment is daylight between. Nick, yep, you got some daylight between?
Yeah, I do on foreign policy. And I think this came out in the one debate between Kamala and Donald. Is that they both are pledged to and in the past have been part of either the head of or the vice president of administrations that increased defense spending as much as was possible, given various budget constraints that were laid down. They both want a military with a lot of new shiny stuff and less oversight. It's possible that that Trump would actually go further than that, because the reason he's being backed by a bunch of Silicon Valley billionaires is pretty explicitly so that, a startup mentality can enter the military-industrial complex. The people who founded Palantir and things like that, that's one of the reasons they've said they're backing Trump. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a real goosing of defense spending under Trump. But he has also been explicit in taking a lot of pride in the fact that he didn't get us into any new wars. And he claims with, I would say, at least some credibility that, that the Hamas attack wouldn't have happened on his watch and Putin wouldn't have gone into Ukraine. I'm cautious about any kind of statement like that, but he said he wants to bring a quick negotiated settlement to Ukraine. And then, like Harris, it's a little bit unclear when it comes to Israel. But I think that Trump has appealed, and he stacked his roster of bully boys, including people like RFK, who talked about this at the Madison Square Garden rally, as well as Tucker Carlson and a variety of other people around him. He's very much pledged to not intervening in places. And I think Harris, in the one debate that they had, really kind of showed basically a almost unreconstructed neocon kind of attitude towards intervention. So I think that's a significant difference to think about.
Though I will flag the absolute weirdness of Trump's narrative about what happened in terms of getting out of Afghanistan, which is, like, as far as I can reconstruct it, he basically says, yeah, I mean, I was definitely kind of getting out of Afghanistan and I was going to do it. And if I had done it, it wouldn't have gone nearly as badly as it went under Biden. So in a way, wasn't it me who got us out of Afghanistan?
But I got us out without all of the people falling off of the planes.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like that fictional world. Yeah.
There's like a it's like a speculative fiction exercise. Like, it's an alt history where Trump got us out of Afghanistan. And I suspect that if you polled voters, I don't know if there's any information about this, that people would, like, there's some percentage of Americans who, like, somehow think that that's the true story. But I will say, like, Biden did get us out of Afghanistan. So
I agree. And, yeah. You know, the other thing that's and I think this is a very not just interesting, but important subthread in this election is that Trump was at war with his generals, with the people, you know, who had been generals, who he put into his cabinet or into the Pentagon and things like that. Some of them are calling him a fascist and a dictator. He is attacking them as, you know, as the incarnation of the deep state, including, people like Mattis, who, you know, screwed up, made it impossible to leave Afghanistan, according to Trump. Trump is a classic bully, where it's like he's in total charge. And then somebody makes him stub his toe and he can't do anything about it. It's very peculiar. But that is also a big talking point for Trump in all of his rallies, which is that he is going to, you know, protect soldiers by getting rid of the deadweight dumbbell generals who are running everything and ruining everything.
Nick, quick follow-up, Ukraine, since you brought that up, and also Tucker Carlson and Vivek Ramaswamy, and I would add J.D. Vance, all three of those people haven't just said, hey, we should, you know, negotiate a settlement. They've also scoffed very openly at why should we even root for Ukraine in this, as opposed to Russia, which is kind of a great culture. Does that worry you? Is that a sense of any worry as America,
absolutely, presumably
under Trump, gets into some kind of lead negotiation role as to the future of Ukraine and Russia?
Yeah, I mean, less that and more the bizarre fanboy attitudes towards Russia. And it's, you know, almost have we forgotten when Tucker Carlson was lounging around in Russian Moscow subways and talking about how clean they were and how he could eat off the floor of them. And, you know, there's no crime, there's no anything in Putin's Russia. It's deeply disturbing. On another level, to the extent that it, you know, it could well be that, you know, if Trump is in the White House, maybe it disrupts the kind of emerging BRICS kind of axis of power throughout the world and things like that. So I don't know. I find, again, you know, each, both Harris and Trump are more alike than different. I do think on foreign policy, we have seen something which is pretty amazing. And particularly when you go back to 2012 or to 2008, where the Republican standard bearers were very much, you know, bellicose foreign policy. Mitt Romney said and was ridiculed for saying Russia is our biggest adversary. John McCain was obviously a military guy who, you know, did not shy away from, you know, singing Beach Boys parody songs about bombing foreign countries and things like that. Trump has really transformed the Republican Party in terms of it. Not just him, but I think of its next generation of leadership is not going to be as interventionist as, you know, the people before him were.
Final follow-up, picking up on that and drawing it backwards towards what Catherine opened with, is there an argument to be had that the increase of tariffs, of making the world go in the opposite direction that it went from 1946 to very recently, which was a generalized global reduction in tariffs, to let's do a lot of tariffs. Doing a lot of tariffs is not a great way to prevent war, is it not?
No, it's a great way not only to immiserate Americans, but also to make foreign policy a lot more fractious, and particularly with places like China. You know, as China goes into recession or anything like that, we would actually have a fair amount of leverage over them. And, you know, Trump, this is also something where Trump has always been kind of stupid on this. I remember back to in the 2016 campaign, where he, you know, answered a question about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And it was clear from the way he was talking about it that he thought it included China as opposed to it being a way to kind of engage China. Rand Paul was the one who called him out on that. He does not have a clear sense of world geography or of, you know, what's going on in the world, even at this late date.
That's okay. He's going to learn it in his 80s. Go on, Catherine.
Can I put in a little pre-advertising for a piece that we just commissioned for the print magazine, I think. Johan Norberg is going to do a big, juicy, "You think China in decline's going to go well?" piece. And I think that that's really an underappreciated point. Like, if we tariff China's imports to us so aggressively that we genuinely dramatically reduce our trade with China and damage the Chinese economy, like, if we further threaten them militarily, like, China, but less economically strong, will be much worse for the U.S. in ways that are less predictable. And I think that that's just very underappreciated when people are like, we're going to teach those Chinese a lesson with the tariffs. It's not going to work. It's going to go badly.
Especially given that the developing world is growing and there is a global middle class now. A majority of people are at or above middle class level. Most of that growth is in the developing world, where China has been very active in terms of giveaways and trade. To the extent that we do something that screws up China and we're not dealing with the rest of the world because of tariffs, then we become the villain in a new era of anti-trade. That's ridiculous. So having said all of this, Trump, I think it's a very effective talking point at the very least to say, you know, the world was a safer place when I was in the White House. And clearly Joe Biden does not inspire anybody, even his own party. And it's not clear that Kamala Harris would either.
So my subject on which there is clear policy daylight between the two candidates and the two political parties is education policy. And it's not even close. It's been a big divergence. This was kind of presaged by the divergence on immigration policies, because both parties were similar on them if you look over time. And then they kind of diverged around 2012 or 13 in a pretty significant way. Something similar happened with education policies, where Democrats went from, you know, Barack Obama appointing a, pro-education reformer guy like Arne Duncan, and we're going to do Race to the Top, and we're going to reward people for doing, interesting kind of voucher experiments. All that is done in the Democratic Party. And what you have left now is Donald Trump says, and I think he means it more than previous Republicans do, although I'm not sure there's a plan for it yet, that he wants to abolish the Department of Education. Meanwhile, Kamala Harris literally appointed Tim Walz as the vice president over a much more electorally palatable, probably, Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania, in large part, I think, because the teachers' unions, which have an incredible amount of power over the Democratic Party, that's what they cared about most of all. She has said very little per previous discussion about education. It's almost funny to read the education reporters from the Washington Post or Education Week try to even figure out where she's been. But broadly speaking, she criticizes Project 2025 for abolishing the Department of Education. But she wants to make higher education free for everybody who comes from families who make less than $125,000 a year. She wants to make community colleges free. She wants to do more student loan debt relief. Trump doesn't want any of that, really. The only thing he would actually, I found a tax that Trump has proposed. He wants to tax university endowments and then use that money to make community college and trade schools free, none of which is going to happen, probably. But at least it's one tax that he's proposed. But the biggest difference between the candidates and the parties right now is that on the state and local level, where education is done, we now have a dozen states over the last 2 years have made backpack funding available, basically allowed public dollars to chase the student, follow the student into private institutions, including religious institutions. That is a absolute revolution in the way that we do education in this country. We might have already passed the peak raw number of students in the publicly managed K-12 system, which is insane, but it's also, I think, true. Most of projections going forward look at that. Trump Biden administration restored the idiotic Title IX requirements that basically removed the ability of students to defend themselves in campus sexual assault investigations. They also made Title IX affect discriminations against transgender students, although it's being held up by the courts currently. Trump would revert that back to where he had it under his administration. In general, the only area in which, from my point of view, as someone who's critical of the way government and education overlap, the only area in which I have much of a problem with where Trump is coming from is that he also wants to get rid of woke in DEI and things like that, diversity, equity, inclusion in schools. And he wants to do that by appointing some kind of federal body to investigate and then punish schools for having too much of that in their curricula, which I think is a recipe for bad things to happen. But generally speaking, very, very, very different policies of the candidates and the parties in a direction where, in my mind at least, it makes Trump look better. I don't know if you guys have thoughts about that issue.
I'm against education.
Yes.
Now that I've gotten, you know, 25 years of education, I don't think we need it anymore.
You want to pull up the ladder behind you?
Yeah.
There you go. All right. Let's go to our listener email of the week, at least here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsors, speaking of education, over at the University of Chicago. Friends, in an election year, it's too easy to get lost in the fog of news and opinion. Understanding the real-life impact of political events can be a challenge in these years. So have we got a podcast for you. It is called Not Another Politics Podcast, brought to you by the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. That's not Kamala Harris, I don't think. Not Another Politics Podcast provides clear, research-driven perspectives on the biggest issues of the day. Get the insights you need to truly understand the political landscape. No spin, just facts. Subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. Let's do that again. harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. Or just look for Not Another Politics Podcast wherever you acquire such audio material. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from the marvelously named Joel Garzaloni, who writes, Roundtablers, I recently read Reason's staff Who We're Voting For piece. I find that kind of transparency refreshing and counted among the top reason that I am a subscriber to the publication. Ding, ding, ding. Question, do any of you believe that closet Trump voter syndrome, can we call that CTVS? No, I guess not. Is present in the halls of Reason magazine at all, or even at an equivalent rate that it exists in the wild. I've heard many, and even some of you, I think, say that a not insignificant portion of people who have and will pull the lever for Trump will never admit it because of the social, professional, personal risk. Aren't you all subject to that same pressure? Or does the rigor of your hiring process ensure that only those who are impervious to such pressures are hired? As proof of my admiration for your transparency, I'm in a mail-in early voting state and cast my ballot for Chase Oliver. As a libertarian who hates the LP's current state trajectory, I was set to abstain discourteously, but Dr. Nick Gillespie's entry in the aforementioned article swayed me. I share Nick's view of the candidate and the issues. His succinct and eloquent statement helped me overcome the part about the LP being a shit show right now. Nick, since you have been mentioned, you get right of first brag and refusal and answer to the question, are there closet Trumpies on the Reason staff?
Well, first I want to commend Joel on sneaking in a sly reference to 1776. The hilarious hit musical comedy about the founding of this country, where the, I believe it's Governor Morris, the representative from New York at the Continental Congress, is constantly saying, I abstain courteously. So kudos, Joe.
Didn't even get it.
I don't think there are any quiet Trump voters at Reason or anywhere else. The Trump voters I meet tend to be pretty open about it. And if anything, it's a little bit too much. You don't even have to ask them who they're voting for. So that's
our Trump voters are like vegans and CrossFitters.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Catherine, go.
I do think, yeah, I mean, I do think that, you know, in this year's roundup, we had two undecideds where 50% of their undecided was Trump, which is, you know, they could have just said undecided. If there was closet Trumpery around here, they could have just said undecided.
That
they
was Liz Wolf and who? So we can just single them out. For
Jerry Tuchilli. Jerry Tuchilli.
They're both for Trump. And let's not kid ourselves.
Well, Tuchilli seemed like it was a kind of a marital question, whereas in Liz Wolf's case, it was more of a despair question. So it's different. It was different. They're coming from different places. But, you know, I think that as I have watched several newsrooms around the country eat their young and their own faces over endorsements, I cannot help but feel like the guy who came up with this idea for us to do this really had some wisdom. And that maybe this was a good idea, because we at Reason are methodological individualists, and voting is an individual act, not an institutional act. So it kind of seems like we got this one right. And I say this as someone who this year really, really had to put on my big girl pants to do this at all. Like, I didn't want to. Because I don't like any of this voting business.
Well, she doesn't even like to vote.
Because because people are just going to be rude about it. And
the pants are so uncomfortable.
The pants are uncomfortable. And people are just in the mood to be mad. And this is what happens as we get closer to the election. People are in the mood to be mad. And whatever we did was going to be a Rorschach blot for people to be mad. And lo and behold, my inbox is full of people who are mad. But compared with what happened at The Nation, if we may briefly discuss, where The Nation endorsed Kamala Harris.
In an unsigned editorial,
right? In an unsigned editorial, like a formal endorsement.
Also and then, unread editorial, by the way.
And then a month later, like 3 weeks later, published The Nation's Fall 2024 intern class opposing that endorsement.
Are you kidding? I didn't even know.
It was in the byline was literally
the fall 2024 interns of
it
the nation.
It wasn't like a bunch of names. It was credited to the fall 2024
and
intern.
And in a way, Peter sent this to me and I was like, there's a way you could have done this that would have been absolutely awesome and hilarious and like to own it.
Except it's The Nation.
I don't know any backstory. I don't know anything about this, but it does. I think that that was probably several weeks of really awful turmoil, again, akin to what's going down at the Washington Post and other places. So I guess I'm just saying this seems like a decent way to be transparent without being pathologically monolithic.
I think it's worth thinking about why would none of the libertarians had reason, you know, full-throatedly endorse Trump. Because a couple people have raised this to me, either publicly or privately. And I don't know, because like I've always voted, with the exception of voting for Walter Mondale in 1984, I've always voted for the Libertarian candidate, even when it was people like Michael Badnarik, who wouldn't get a driver's license in Texas because they asked for ID or something like that. And getting a driver's license. And, I think libertarians who are aghast that more like LP members are not endorsing Trump. The fact that Trump is a massive spender, the fact that he has called for the shutdown of speech and libel laws and punitive action, the fact that he is talking about mass deportations, talking about millions of people being rounded up, like it's worth Trump people kind of recognizing like why should libertarians put up with so much anti-libertarian stuff from him if we are in fact libertarian. And if Trump had been, I am going to get out of the way, I'm going to cut taxes, I'm going to cut business regulations, I'm going to fix immigration in a way which doesn't equate to claiming that Haitians who are here legally are eating cats, which is not true, I would have considered voting for Trump.
So if he were different person?
No, but this is like, you know what, like the anger and the demonization of immigrants is not central. I don't think it's central to his project. And if we talk about like the Madison Square Garden rally or even the Republican National Convention, there is a positive agenda that Trump is advancing. And he could be at 60%. I would argue if he kept to the small government spending stuff and left the culture war stuff behind. I mean, there's a sense now that it's all culture wars, but it's really not, I don't think. But that's why I think libertarians en masse are not voting for Trump. Because I would love to vote for a guy who seriously is going to pardon Ross Ulbricht. I don't know that that's true because Trump is a liar about a lot of stuff. That would be great. And I would almost vote for him on that one issue if I believed he did that. And if he wasn't talking about deporting millions of people, many of whom look more American than the people on this podcast, meaning we're all going to be in for a weird bunch of hurt.
On the other hand, you have Stephanie Slade on this podcast last week channeling Patrick Ruffini, who you've interviewed, Nick, who argues that the realignment in American politics between Democrats and Republicans right now is at least heavily and maybe primarily about culture war issues. And that is one of the reasons why the economic debate that we are having, the fiscal picture debates that we are having, are so stupid, is because nobody really cares about them, because the elections are being fought entirely on culture war grounds.
Well said. Let's get to lightning round here. On Friday, Donald Trump tweeted, and yes, he's back on Twitter. Quote, I'll do my best to be faithful to various capitalization quirks. Cease and desist. I, together with many attorneys and legal scholars, am watching the sanctity of the 2024 presidential election very closely because I know better than most the rampant cheating and skullduggery that has taken place by the Democrats in the 2020 presidential election. It was a disgrace to our nation. Therefore, the 2024 election, where votes have just started being cast, will be under the closest professional scrutiny. And when I win, those people that cheated will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, which will include long-term prison sentences so that this depravity of justice does not happen again. We cannot let our country further devolve into a third world nation, and we won't. Please beware that this legal exposure extends to lawyers, political operatives, donors, illegal voters, and corrupt election officials. Those involved in unscrupulous behavior will be sought out, caught, and prosecuted at levels, unfortunately, never seen before in our country. End quote. Congratulations, America. Trump's tweet came on the same day that we got news from Lancaster County in the swing state of Pennsylvania that officials found 2,500 suspected fraudulent voter registration forms that had been dropped off at a ballot location. And also this very morning on Monday in Vancouver, Washington, there was an incendiary device that was put into a ballot box drop-off location, burning literally hundreds of ballots. Day before, across the Columbia River, the Great Columbia River in Portland, Oregon, there was another suspected arson attack at another ballot drop-off location. This is fine.gif. Catherine, 2 years ago, you published an Eric Boehm cover story about where we're at with election integrity historically and right now. So how are we doing? How have we been doing since the whole Stop the Steal shenanigans?
Unfortunately, I think we are doing worse. Thanks for asking. You know, there's this weird phenomenon that's happening right now where Republican voters are being told, get out the vote. It's really important to vote. Vote by mail if you have to, but vote in person. It's better. And also, our electoral system is completely corrupt. Whatever the vote counts are, they won't be accurate. And we, you know, assume that that bias will be against Trump voters. But regardless, it's all a mess. Those two messages are in weird tension. You know, in Arizona, there's been a push to tell Republican voters not to vote by mail so that their votes can count on the day of the election, because they want to set up this condition in Arizona, and this is true in other places as well, where Trump appears to be winning when the polls close. And so then later, if Trump loses because mail-in ballots swing against him, that is the thing that will intuitively feel to Americans like maybe the election was stolen from Trump. So they are just actively trying to create the conditions where it looks like the election was stolen from Trump. And they're going to do it. Like, if he wins, okay, we'll just set that aside. But I've said before, and I believe that it is genuinely possible that we will have some kind of unrest on the, you know, on the night of Election Day in both directions. So there will be people who think that both candidates have won and are mad about it in different parts of the country. It doesn't look good. It really doesn't look good. And the sowing of concern about how our elections are being run is partially real, and it is partially self-reinforcing.
Nick, is there any chance on God's green earth that Trump won't claim that the election was stolen if he loses?
No. And I mean, the real question for Trump is whether he'll continue to insist it was fake even if he wins, which he did after 2016. 77% of Americans are very confident or confident about the election integrity of their local areas. You know, that's that's pretty high. I don't think there is, in reality, any large-scale voter fraud that has been shown to be determinative in elections. One of the things that I'll add to Catherine's claim about the sowing of dissent about the election is this is something where the Democrats have to also own, you know, 8 years now of Russiagate and of claiming that Hillary Clinton lost in large part because of some kind of electoral interference. When major party members are, you know, shouting from the rooftops that our election systems don't have integrity, that is a real problem. But I think most Americans recognize whoever wins the election, and, you know, the votes will be counted partly on the day of, and then, you know, it's about 50% of votes are going to be done early voting. So it's going to take a while to count those after the election. I think the vast majority of people will accept the vote tallies because they do reflect who we voted for.
Peter, what can you tell us that we don't know about electoral voting, election, you know, the good word, the trustworthiness or something?
Integrity.
That's it.
Matt, there's trouble. Matt has trouble saying integrity, recognizing integrity.
I think that's the thing we didn't know.
Yeah.
There's going to be skullduggery. There's going to be skullduggery, and I'm very worried about this. And I think this needs to be part of our political project going forward, is that both parties, the senior representatives, officials, people who are in charge of, who are running for president or who are involved in presidential campaigns, need to find some way to come together and lay out conditions in advance that they will, under which they will accept defeat. And this is one of the big problems with Donald Trump, is that when you ask him, will you accept defeat? He will only say, well, you know, I'll accept the results if it's fair and I'm going to win. And he basically won't commit to accepting defeat under any specific circumstances in advance. And the Democrats are also bad on a bunch of this stuff in different ways, but Trump is the worst about this. Trump is absolutely committed to simply not accepting any results that he doesn't like. And that's not the same as being willing to accept results that are unpleasant but true. And this is what we saw in 2020. It was a bad scene that Trump at least allowed, sometimes tacitly encouraged, arguably directed in at least some of the specifics coming from the Oval Office. It is a bad scene. And when you don't have the ability to have a peaceful transfer of power where one side says, I lost, I admit that I lost, I'm upset about it, it's unfortunate, I don't support this other person, but I lost, and we are now going to accept that I lost the election. When you don't have both sides pre-committing to those conditions, you end up in the situation we are in which a lot of people who live in big cities are afraid that there is going to be rioting, that there's going to be unrest. Our building here at Reason is sending out like emergency instructions for what is going to happen in the days after Election Day. I know that this is just a concern that is happening all over the city here in DC, but also in New York. And that is a terrible, terrible position to be in, where we shouldn't have to take emergency action to board up a building, to have extra security, to say, look, what are we going to do? We've had meetings about what we are going to do if there are riots on the streets in Washington, D.C. That doesn't mean that we're definitely going to have them. That doesn't mean that it's a sure thing. But it is a bad scene. It is a bad situation in which this is now assumed that if Donald Trump doesn't win the election, he is going to say, actually, I did win the election. And then he is going to take some action, whether it's completely ridiculous or deadly serious or some combination of both. We have no idea. But then he is going to take some action after he says, I actually won the election, even though all the evidence says he did. If that is the situation we end up in, which I don't know. But if that is the situation we end up in, that is going to be an ugly couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months, and maybe an ugly couple of years for America.
Hooray! All right, let's get to our end of a podcast. What we've all been consuming. Catherine, what kind of beautiful, transcendent art have you consumed since we last talked?
Unfortunately, I do not think that this segue is going to cheer you up as much as you hoped. I don't have like rockets for you today. I have a really cool book that I just read called Radium Girls by Kate Moore.
That's all right.
It is about the women who worked in wartime factories using the newly discovered radium to paint watch dials and instrument dials so that they would glow for our boys on the front. And it turns out that you got to use like a really tiny brush and you dip it in the radium and then you paint and then you kind of like lick the brush to make it really pointy. So the thing is, radium was brand new at this time. People were like, it's a miracle substance. And you got to, like, the thing that this book drove home for me was, what a crazy moment when it was like, Marie Curie was like, I found this new thing. And it's like, you can see through people's bodies with it. And also, it glows and maybe it cures cancer. And I'm not sure, man. It seems cool. So people were very into radium. They were like drinking radium water. It was just kind of considered to be this like miraculous substance. As Reason Roundtable listeners might know, it gives you cancer. It gives you cancer if you put it in your mouth over and over. It gives you like fairly horrific jaw cancer, and then you die painfully. So this is the story of those girls, and in particular, it's the story of them suing their employer, who told them over and over, "This is completely safe. Don't be silly. This is completely safe. Don't be silly." And they're like dropping like flies. So it's fascinating story about science, about industry, about kind of plausible deniability. It does end in the creation of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. So this is the radium.
Tragedy.
The radium girls got us OSHA. And I think it's, you know, the my takeaway is it's sort of similar to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory story where, you know, genuine malfeasance on the part of a corporation, genuine attempts to kind of squelch true information and keep it out of the public eye, rectified in part in the courts, but then encoded in bureaucracies that turn out to be fairly disastrous for the workers that they were originally meant to help. So it's a really interesting book, Radium Girls by Kate Moore. And it's a nice companion piece to The Face Maker, which was a book I recommended on this podcast a while back about World War II veterans and the founding of plastic surgery. I don't know. I just like it when people's faces rot off. Go
Apparently.
For it.
There's a great, I don't recall whether it's a Twitter account or just a series of tweets from a couple of years ago that's Imperial OSHA and it's from the Empire in Star Wars. And it's just grading all of the buildings that you see in Star Wars. It's like, hey, there's a walkway here. It's 100 feet up. There's a giant drop and there's absolutely no handhold. You're going to get your safety stuff right here. And it's just like, it just goes through all the Empire's buildings and how incredibly unsafe they are. And I think actually maybe the Empire does need OSHA. They're probably losing a lot of the stormtroopers.
First of all,
maybe that's
statist.
Why they lost to the rebels.
Statist.
They were too bureaucratic.
One other great tidbit from this book, the girls used to wear their nice clothes to the factory so that they would get the radium dust on them so they would be sparkly at parties.
The dawn of radiation and the effects on women's bodies is also a key plot point in the new Neal Stephenson novel, Polistan.
That's true.
I had a job in high school working in a factory where after a couple days, I was huffing all kinds of fumes. And I went to the people who owned it. And I was like, you know, I feel kind of lightheaded. Are you sure this stuff is okay? And they were like, oh, yeah, it's absolutely okay. And then 2 days later, they were like, okay, don't go back in that room anymore. And I was like, okay.
And that's how you ended up way you are.
That's right. And suddenly I felt myself becoming something different, something better. Speaking of potentially disastrous innovations, technological innovations, I went to see a play called Happenstance, which was written by Ben Schiller, who is a journalist at CoinDesk, and he and his team at CoinDesk helped bring down SBF and FTX. They're really an interesting group of journos talking about crypto and Bitcoin. And his play Happenstance is being billed as the first play about Bitcoin. It is a very funny, by terms, funny, sad, weird, utopian, kind of disturbing yet totally wonderful play about a Bitcoin scammer who is about, it's set on the weekend before he's about to go to the slammer. His parents show up who are deeply invested in the business, his brother and his girlfriend. And it's a very good play. It was on the Lower East Side. It had a short run, which has now concluded. But look for Happenstance to wherever it gets produced next. It's a wonderful kind of commentary on Bitcoin. And it also gives rise to the idea of, like, you know, we're at the beginning of a place where, you know, Bitcoin, depending on who you talk to, is definitely in the top 10 currencies that's being used on a daily basis around the world. Bitcoin is here to stay. And how will Bitcoin affect media and culture and society? It's going to be more than just the way that it does, you know, it allows people to have transactions or speculate or anything like that. So I was very, very happy to see Happenstance by Ben Schiller, which was directed by Roman Alpier. Really delightful.
Nice. Peter, what did you consume?
I watched the movie Strange Darling. It's a tight, twisty, surprisingly subversive thriller about a serial killer stalking the Mountain West. It's directed and written by a guy named J.T. Molnar, who is the heir to the Freakling Brothers Haunted House franchise in Las Vegas. So this is one of the biggest private haunted house chains in the United States. Started in his family's garage, and now they have like three houses next to each other. It's this whole big thing. But this is a kind of a very classic thriller in a lot of ways, a little bit Tarantino influenced because it is told in six chapters. And the great thing is you get the title card. It's Strange Darling, a thriller in six chapters. And then you get chapter and it flips to, and you start with, I think it's chapter three. And then it's like, then back to number one, and then like five, and then like two, four, it's something like that. Forget the exact order, but it's all told out of order in ways that makes sense once you've seen it all, of course, and it slowly reveals what's actually going on to you. Just a great, really nicely shot, mostly two-hander with two main performers. It's kind of a chase movie, kind of a thriller sort of situation, but also a great cameo role by Ed Begley Jr., who shows up as an environmentalist, as a hippie, a biker guy who, well, some things happen in his orbit and maybe to him. It's very good, a little bit underrated, and you can watch it on streaming right now.
I am, just to be clear, the co-writer of probably the best 20-second song with Ed Begley in the title.
What is
can
the
you
title?
Hum a few bars, Matt Welch?
I could, yeah. Called, I think, Ed Begley Knows, or Even Ed Begley Knows. It's classic stuff, but we're going to have to save that for another episode of the Reason Roundtable. My what you was, I found myself last night in dire need to transport myself away from the vulgarities of American politics, which seemed to be enduring and deepening and accelerating in the final days of this campaign. And so I said to myself, is it possible that I haven't seen every single Ken Burns documentary? And the answer was yes, I hadn't seen the one about Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson from 1997. So I watched the first half of that, so I didn't get to the juicy Sally Hemings stuff. And this is in 97 before all the DNA, the subsequent evidence came into that. But I think
before they found Sally Hemings' Gap dress.
Yes.
Wow.
Too soon. Too soon.
He was talking about DNA at White House chicanery.
Anyways, something about the of 1990s Ken Burns like resonates. Maybe it's the haircuts. It's a youthful George Will. Yeah. But like it still like has sort of American naivete and optimism in it. Just really, really liked it. It's one of my favorite ones I've seen from him. And Thomas Jefferson is such a crazily interesting figure with just this electric writing on occasion that you can't believe, and very inscrutable. Like they keep zooming into his eyes in those famous portraits that you've seen before. And it's like, what's he thinking in there? It's really like respectfully and very critically.
Yeah,
done.
It's about Thomas Jefferson, Matt, not you.
Yeah. What?
You just went through a thing where you were desperate to project yourself into something out of this world. So I'm just suggesting perhaps Thomas Jefferson's eyes, you are projecting yourself into them a little bit.
When you look into the abyss gazes back.
Yeah.
At any rate, it's pretty good.
I tried that with a James Cameron movie.
Check it out. All right, that's all the time we have.
Who's your favorite Thomas Jefferson, Matt Welch? Is it Ken Howard from The White Shadow? In the musical 1776, he plays Jefferson.
Can we do some
Jefferson.
Olympics stats now?
Yeah.
which Thomas anyways, Jefferson can yeah. jump the longest?
Stop, please.
Thomas Jefferson Clinton is always my favorite Thomas Jefferson. Anyways, that's all the time we have for. We're looking forward to seeing a lot of you live in person at the Reason Roundtable pre-election show at the Village Underground in New York City. The tickets are sold out. You can still get on the waiting list. And you can still just go in the neighborhood and drink, meet up with us afterwards, whatever. It's going to be fun. There are other events that Reason is involved with that you can see at reason.com/events. Nick, are there any that you would like to point to in particular on that page?
Yeah, sure. On Monday, November 18th, we're doing a live interview with Martin Gurry, the former CIA analyst who wrote The Revolt of the Public in 2014, or published it in 2014, which is one of the most prescient and predictive books of the 21st century. That's going to be at Maxwell Social, but go to reason.com/events. to buy tickets, which are going faster than Matt's sanity at this point.
Go to all of our podcasts, reason.com/podcast. You can also donate to the nonprofit 501c3 that makes all of our work possible over at reason.com/donate. That's it. We'll see you on Monday or whatever. And good luck voting, Catherine. Goodbye.